Elon, you know, several years ago made a tweet about Dogecoin and it just sent it soaring through the roof. And then I think a week later, he said something like, oh, I just figured out that cryptocurrency is really bad for the environment. And all of cryptocurrency crashed across the board. So it is easily influenced, but the more people who actually end up investing in it or buying into it, the less volatile it becomes. And so I like to kind of remind people that, you know, everyone thinks the US dollar is based on the gold standard still, but it's not. Really, what gives the US dollar value is that everyone in this country understands that it's a dollar, believes in its value, and therefore uses it.
Hi, my name is Mina Kim, your host of The Click Line. I've worked on Wall Street for over 14 years. Then I built out Orange Theory Fitnesses and sold them to a private equity firm. And upon that exit, started investing in women and minority startups, as well as advising women who are getting divorced with financial consulting and strategy. Welcome, everybody. I want to welcome a very special guest today, Victoria Fife. She is a forensic accounting specialist in digital assets at CBIZ Forensic Consulting Group, who has over 10 years experience of litigation support and matrimonial and civil matters. She is the regional ambassador of SoCal for the Association of Women in Cryptocurrency, a 2024 Women in FinTech Powerless honoree, and what I have dubbed as the queen of crypto tracing. Oh. So thank you for being on the Click Line today, Victoria.
Thank you for having me.
I'm super excited to have you, and I am sure the audience is as well. So if you could tell everybody a little bit about what you do.
Yeah, so since 2016, I've been a forensic accountant, mostly specializing in high net worth family law. But more recently, the last several years, actually, have been branching into fraud and otherwise civil or criminal cases. And that's because of the emergence of cryptocurrency. So starting probably 4 years ago, 2021, we started to see more cases that regularly had cryptocurrency on them, and occasionally that would branch into breach of fiduciary duty claims, which is a type of fraud. So, you know, you get enough experience with that, it ends up turning into attorneys referring you out to civil and criminal cases too. But yeah, I mean, I just happened to understand crypto. I'd been in it myself since 2014, and you know, the opportunity came across my desk and I took it.
What percentage of your cases would you say are fraud compared to kind of matrimonial civil cases?
Probably less than 10%. It's not incredibly common yet, but it is becoming more common. But more often, I mean, we're seeing bigger cases where cryptocurrency scams take place. People are targeting married individuals for cryptocurrency scams. So while I'm already processing the family law case and working on disclosures and stuff for cryptocurrency and digital assets, sometimes a scam will happen and then it turns into a different kind of case completely.
Okay. Is this the type of scam? Are these the type of scams that you're talking about where people get a random call and they're like, hey, I need you to send me money now, like the Tinder swindler who just got caught again?
I know, I saw that too. And it seems like there's like more of them emerging. It's crazy how many of these people are out there. But I mean, yeah, sometimes it's a phone call, but more often than not, it's through a text message. Those like random texts you'll get if you're, you know, coming back off vacation, and it might be from an area code that, you know, belongs to the area that you just visited. And they're like, hey, it was so great hanging out with you. Like, hope to see you again soon. Or I'm going to be in your area soon. Like, let me know. And then you're like, oh no, like maybe I forgot to save them as my contact. And so you start interacting with them. Or, you know, you recognize that it's a wrong number, respond that, hey, I think you have the wrong number. And then it opens up sort of a conversation with them where they're like, oh, I'm so sorry. And if you're like, oh, don't worry about it, they kind of just keep going. Well, you seem nice. Like, you know, are you in the area? And like, it kind of grows from there. And of course, if you're, you know, going through the process of divorce, having that kind of companionship that seems like it, you know, is almost kismet is very easy to kind of lean into.
Oh, wow. Okay. And so just backing up a little bit, crypto, you know, obviously everyone has heard about But can you break down for us, as if I'm your grandma, how crypto works and kind of the differences between the major ones that we see, like Bitcoin, Ethereum, XRP? You know, what are the differences? Because it's so confusing with all of these different ones out there and what really has value.
Yeah, so cryptocurrency in general, and especially the version of cryptocurrency that the United States is starting to adopt into the economy, things like stablecoins, for the most part, those are going to act just the same as using your credit card to swipe to pay for things. Those are like a one-to-one peg to the US dollar. Most people won't realize it once it is adopted by the financial institutions. A lot of people are already using blockchain technology whenever you send a transfer on Venmo or Zelle. It's very, very similar to that. So in a way, a lot of people won't need to understand like the in-depth, complex mechanisms of cryptocurrency unless they're looking at getting into actual digital assets like Bitcoin or Ether or any of the Ethereum-based blockchain assets. But basically, the primary difference is when you are talking about these digital assets is that Bitcoin is more of a commodity, similar to gold. It's limited in supply, and the idea is that with time, it will increase in value. So that is sort of something that people like to invest in. We most often see people buying it and holding it for long periods of time. That can technically be used to purchase things, thanks to like, you know, Coinbase Visa, Crypto.com Visa, and now we have a MetaMask. I believe MasterCard is teaming up with MetaMask. So you are able to actually use cryptocurrencies to buy things. A lot of there's a whole myth out there that like, oh, well, what's the point of it? You can't even spend it on things. You totally can. It's just a lot of people don't want to buy things with it because it's continuing to increase in value. But on the other end of the spectrum from Bitcoin, you have Ethereum-based assets like Ether. There's also, you know, just like the stablecoin example I was giving a second ago, USDC, USDT, these are pegged one-to-one to the dollar. Those types of assets in general, the Ethereum ecosystem is mostly designed for Web3 development. And that's kind of like the next generation of the internet. And it's not limited in supply. In fact, it's built on this type of mechanism that's referred to as staking mechanism. But basically what that means is that the longer you hold it, the more of it you're kind of creating. So the more people have Ethereum staked, or the more people who own it, they're actually, without even knowing it, they're producing more of it, which kind of, you know, dilutes its value, right? It's diluting the supply. So that's not necessarily something to invest in unless it's a specific, you know, security type of investment. If you're investing in this, like, you know, internet-based company and this is their cryptocurrency, that's a different story. But for the most part, you have commodities, you have securities, you have stable coins. So that's it in a nutshell. A lot of people will try to invest in Ethereum and they just have no idea what it is. So we see that quite a bit.
Right. And so when you mean stable coin, so USDC and USDT, they're pegged to the US dollar, you said, right? So pegged means it's following the price of the US dollar, but it's not backed by the US dollar.
Right. Not per the government. But yeah, it is more like a derivative. It's sort of just, it's representing the same movements that the US dollar would. It's always pretty much worth about a dollar. Now, we did see a situation with a different cryptocurrency previously where it was also pegged to the US dollar, but then the entire company kind of collapsed and went under this whole scandal. And because of that, now it's worth, you know, like a fraction of a penny. It's like completely worthless. So that's something to keep in mind with things like USDC and USDT, Tether. Is that these are still, there's still, you know, a whole organization behind them. It's not necessarily actually the US dollar. And so I think that's why the United States government now is trying to step in and kind of claim the US dollar for itself. And in that case, our actual, it's called a CBDC, but basically the government-backed stablecoin, quote unquote, is actually backed by the US dollar.
Okay. And so for me, I worked 14 years on Wall Street, and you know, we were taught fundamental investment analysis on each security is vital to understanding, you know, the future projected earnings and performance, et cetera. And with crypto, it's such a hard concept for people on the street, right? Because there's no intrinsic value. And I'm sure you've seen what, you know, Warren Buffett and others have said. So because it's valued at whatever anyone else in the group that's holding it is valuing it at, right? So that's why there's high volatility, et cetera. And so what do you think about that?
So certainly there are different types of digital assets where it's very easily and very heavily influenced by, you know, how many people believe in it on this day. Things like Dogecoin, that's like a perfect example, where, you know, a lot of people were backing it. Elon, you know, several years ago made a tweet about Dogecoin and it just sent it soaring through the roof. And then I think a week later, he said something like, oh, I just figured out that cryptocurrency is really bad for the environment. And all of cryptocurrency crashed across the board. So it is easily influenced. But the more people who actually end up investing in it or buying into it, the less volatile it becomes. And so I like to kind of remind people that, you know, everyone thinks the US dollar is based on the gold standard still, but it's not. Really, what gives the US dollar value is that everyone in this country understands that it's a dollar, believes in its value, and therefore uses it. And like, of course, you know, basic, you know, Econ 101 tells you, like, if everyone wanted to pull out all their cash from these banks right now, there is not enough US dollars in supply for us to be able to do that. So cryptocurrency kind of offers a solution in that way, that you don't need to necessarily pull physical cash out, but each cryptocurrency issued, each part of a cryptocurrency issued is actually owned by you. So when you want to sell it, when you want to get out of it, when you want to convert it to something else, you can. You're in full control of that. But yeah, I mean, the basis of value is like, I mean, look at what happened with the Tesla stock. It's kind of the same thing. For a while there, I think a lot of us were like, wait, but like, you know, their financials aren't really adding up. Like, why is it so valuable as a stock? But really, I mean, I think this is just the generation we're living in where people just, they put their money where their beliefs are and what they believe is going to go up, goes up.
Right. And just so the audience understands too, the creation of the dollar, the actual paper currency, was created because people didn't want to carry around gold bars everywhere. So it was original. It's like the original way to back the gold that you had. So that's why the paper currency was created, so we can easily pay for things. And so this is, I guess, like the next iteration of that, right?
Yeah. And I feel like during the pandemic, we had a supply shortage for cash and for, I mean, coins specifically. And so the United States government, and I mean, obviously the Fed, was just kind of having this like moment of panic, like, wait a minute, like, we don't have enough change. We don't have enough dollars. I remember like every drive through everywhere we would try to like go pick up, you know, during the toilet paper craze, we'd go to the store or something and they'd ask us if we could pay in cash. And it's because like even these stores were not able to get the cash that they needed. And personally, I have not been a fan of cash for many, many years. I've been a cards only girl for a long time because I don't want to have to worry about where I put that dollar. I don't like the awkward feeling of waiting for someone to hand you the change and having to put your change away before the next person can get checked out. So I do think it's very similar in that way, that like people don't really want to carry cash money around anymore, whether it's for safety reasons or for me, like just, you know, an inconvenience. It's a lot easier for us to just kind of tap and pay or use your phone to Venmo a friend. So yeah, I think it's exactly the same type of scenario.
So is there a difference in holding the crypto in like Coinbase or Gemini and then holding it in some other wallet?
Yeah, so what you're bringing up here is the exchanges versus wallets issue. So this is something too that I think like everyone could kind of take a page, take a lesson out of this a little bit, is that people think that when they buy cryptocurrency on an exchange like Coinbase, that they're actually in possession of the cryptocurrency, they own it. While that's true to an extent, you have a claim to it, it's technically owned still by Coinbase, even if it shows up in your account as like, you know, this is part of your balance, until you actually transfer it to a wallet, which is, you know, it can be something like MetaMask, that's a hot wallet, or it can be something like a Trezor or Ledger, which is like a little software wallet. until you actually transfer it to a wallet that you own the private seed phrase for, you're not actually the true owner of it. You just own kind of like what represents that cryptocurrency, but the exchange itself still has all of it in its possession. So that's really the difference there.
So if the exchange goes down, could you potentially lose it all?
Yeah, we saw what happened with FTX. That was kind of a nightmare. But and for anyone who doesn't know, Sam Bankman-Fried was the CEO of an exchange called FTX a few years ago. And this exchange was, it seemed so reputable. We had Tom Brady doing like commercials for it, all sorts of athletes doing commercials for it, a lot of actors, celebrities doing Super Bowl commercials for it and stuff. And, you know, every celebrity, anyone who was anyone, was rocking an FTX sticker or a bag or whatever. They had the craziest advertising everywhere. And it seemed like, you know, this is going to take over Coinbase even. And Coinbase has been number one for a long time in the United States. But then all of a sudden in 2021, you know, it comes out that Sam Bankman-Fried has, you know, been skirting around certain financing. He's violating a lot of, you know, U.S. policy and getting around some regulations that he shouldn't be getting around. He's buying himself basically an island. He bought himself a huge mansion. And for a guy who was always seen, you know, pretty messy looking. He kind of always looked like he was wearing pajamas almost, or like he just rolled out of bed and like Maiko skateboarding later.
Or didn't shower for 3 weeks.
Right. Hadn't had a haircut in a year. I mean, it was very surprising. I don't think anyone expected it. He kind of touted how humble he was and how he didn't like to live this extravagant life, but he totally was the whole time. And the money he used to fund all of that was money that people were putting into the exchange and they were seeing in their accounts that they had, you know, Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum assets and stuff. And they thought, you know, the money's safe. I have those assets. But obviously there was nothing underneath. And so it was kind of fluff. Now, it's my understanding that starting earlier this year or late last year, he started to repay investors back. So that's like kind of the light at the end of the tunnel, is that at least he kind of seems to have figured out how to repay investors. But that's not always going to happen.
Right. And it won't be the full amount.
Probably not. Yeah.
What's shocking too in that case was that he had an accounting in like the QuickBooks,
yeah,
in the QuickBooks file. And I've been through a due diligence process by private equity firms, and the amount of questioning on, you know, legit item line items was so painful. But the fact that all of these VC firms and huge names were like, okay, it's in QuickBooks, like no big deal, it was like astonishing to me.
He was really, really good at kind of pulling the wool over people's eyes, I think. He had a lot of people convinced that he had a big team working for him. He had a lot of backing from other very reputable investors. So people were kind of like, well, if so-and-so is into this, it should be safe. Well, if so-and-so is doing this, if they have his back, you know, then like, I mean, they must have done their due diligence. Like, I don't really need to go as far. I can trust them. And then it, like, you know, after enough of this, it's almost like social Ponzi scheming in a way, like where you're kind of piggybacking off of other people's names to use their name later. After enough of that, it starts to kind of crumble. People start talking, and that's exactly what happened. And they realize, wait, he totally just played all of us. So insane. And it turns out he only had a team of like 3 or 4 people total, like running that whole exchange, which is nuts. And that's like before AI really took over too. So it's not even like there was really an excuse. Like, it's crazy.
What do you think about quantum computing and its ability to be able to hack wallets? I've read it could be anywhere from like 2 to 3 years from now, or it could be 5 to 10 years from now. We don't know. What do you think about that? Because that's a potential threat, right?
Yeah, I kind of think that it may already be here. I am on Reddit a lot. I go to the subreddit called Crypto Scams, and whenever I see people who, you know, have lost a lot of money or something, or they have a very unique case, sometimes I'll chime in and I'll leave a comment. I'm not doing anything through direct messaging or private messaging at all, but I'll just kind of look up their wallet address and find out like where it ended up, and then kind of comment it for them. And if they have questions, they can message me. But in a lot of these cases, we're seeing this a lot more where people have a Trezor wallet or they're very, very well versed in how to protect their assets, you know, like writing down the seed phrase on a piece of paper, never putting it on a computer, never letting it be seen in front of a camera lens, putting it in a safe deposit box, not opening it for 10 years. One day they wake up, check their app, and all their money's gone. How did that happen? So I think the only explanation there is that quantum computing is already here. People are already figuring out how to hack these. And a 12-word seed phrase is just not good enough now. And 24-word seed phrase is also turning out to not be good enough anymore. So I think that we have no choice but to continue to develop the technology behind these wallets and, you know, what's actually protecting them. And I know that that's already in the works right now. But yeah, I mean, I think it's a real risk. And I think the only solution, especially for all of these crypto developers, is to kind of pitch in and help the wallet manufacturers figure out how to protect, how consumers can protect themselves. Yeah, it's pretty scary.
Yeah, it's super scary, especially, you know, it's since a lot of people are putting a lot of their net worth into, you know, these investments. And, you know, I would just tell people this is something that is, yeah, certainly personal. Everyone can do whatever they want with their money, but stay diversified, and no one investment should be a majority of your net worth, is my personal opinion.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that's all I have to say about that.
Yeah. And I mean, really the only way to protect yourself from that, you know, essentially seed phrase hacking, is to keep your money in the exchange, at which point you're at the mercy of a potential FTX scandal. But I know that, you know, exchanges like Coinbase are going through the necessary steps with the SEC and, you know, federal regulators to make sure that they're in full compliance at all times. They're reporting things appropriately. I believe they're publicly traded now, so they're at the mercy of investors now. So I think those are kind of clear signs of an exchange that can be trusted. But then you've got the issue of fees, and like you're paying just the same way that you would with a bank, you know, you're paying them to kind of handle everything for you. Again, you're not the true owner of it. So that kind of takes out the whole point of cryptocurrency, which is that you're in full control of, you know, your money at all times. Now you're right back into that same financial institution system that cryptocurrency was developed to free us from. So yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah. So there's trade-offs to it. And so when you've been brought into a matrimonial case, has there ever been a time where you haven't been able to trace the activity? Because the whole, you know, theme around crypto is not being able to be traced. And that's what, you know, people have always thought. But is that really true?
Not at all. The biggest myth, I think, that I've heard so far, and I still hear podcasts, like news podcasts. The Financial Times, I think, recently had an episode where they said, you know, cryptocurrency is anonymous. It's untraceable. And I'm just sitting in my car, like shouting back, like, it is the most traceable asset you can have. Like, even if it's in an exchange, like we can subpoena the exchanges, and like even the overseas exchanges are starting to cooperate more with us. So like, I may not be able to trace through an exchange because it's like a banking institution. None of those transactions are kept on the blockchain. So I can't trace them on the blockchain, but I can go to that institution and ask them for that information. And I can figure out exactly where assets are going from a wallet. And if I see it enter into an exchange, I'm going to assume that that exchange has an account in this person's name. So we end up actually discovering undisclosed exchange accounts by using the system, by sort of tracing on the blockchain. And it always tells the truth. It always tells on people. So like people are always concerned about like, oh, my spouse is hiding money or, you know, whatever. When we go in and look at it, there is no hiding. Like there's really no hiding here. We're going to find everything because no one sets out in crypto being like, I'm going to hide all of this the whole time. Every single transaction is designed for hiding over a span of a long period of time. Eventually, there's going to be a trip up. Eventually, even if they set out, you know, with the intention of hiding money, there's always going to be a mistake where we find it every time. And then sometimes, you know, we find wallets that they didn't disclose and it has a small amount of money and it hasn't been looked at in, you know, seven or eight years or something. And they're genuinely shocked that they forgot they had it. And you can always tell when that's the case, too. But that's the nature of crypto. And yeah, Long story short, it's the most traceable asset. It's absolutely traceable. I've never had a case where I couldn't trace the cryptocurrency.
Even if it stays in the wallet and doesn't go into an exchange?
Well, that's the thing about crypto, is at some point it came out of an exchange. So the only way to really get, well, in most cases, you have to be very, very skilled to figure out how to get cryptocurrency into a wallet without using an exchange. But there's still going to be something called an on-ramping app that is used to actually purchase the cryptocurrency using US dollars. So we're going to see that outflow, whether it's through the bank statements, we'll figure it out. There's a lot of different intermediary institutions that I know to look for. So usually it starts out with just asking for all the bank records, all the statements for the marital period. And at that point, we can kind of pinpoint, you know, at what point someone started investing or when they may have purchased cryptocurrency and then on-ramped it into a wallet. But the majority of the time, I want to say 98% of the time, the way it happens is they opened up an exchange account, they bought some cryptocurrency, they sent it to a wallet, and now that wallet's all that they're disclosing or something. So if that's the case, I can trace it back to that exchange account. I can get that transaction history and we can find out, is this really his only wallet or her only wallet or, you know, whatever the case is. But yeah, I mean, generally the rule is that you have to go through an exchange to get your cryptocurrency onto a wallet. So that makes it easier.
And so have you had instances in court where either the opposing side or the judge has difficulty understanding the platforms and how the mechanics work and questioning your kind of ability to do what you do? Because it's such a new area, you know?
Yeah, totally. I haven't ever had my abilities questioned by the court. I actually haven't had my abilities questioned by opposing counsels, even, knock on wood. But more often than not, I'm being questioned by either opposing client, the person who invested in the cryptocurrency, or my own client who's like, how do I know that you really know what you're doing? Because they often don't know what it is that I'm doing. So I've gotten really good at explaining to people what this process looks like, what the different outcomes are, how everything actually works, and explaining to the courts very basic things about cryptocurrency and blockchain technology. And I give a lot of these presentations. I've been giving even presentations for magistrates and, you know, other counties and out of state. But yeah, I mean, I give a lot of presentations to bar associations for the attorneys, the Beverly Hills Bar Association, the LA Bar. I feel like there's a handful. Oh, I did one for the American Bar Association. That was a national conference. But now that the attorneys are starting to kind of get used to the language and get used to what the process looks like, we're trying to get the word out with other accountants as well. So that way you don't necessarily need to get an expert or someone specializing in this to do especially very basic work with crypto. So I think really just educating people is kind of tearing down that sort of wall. And hopefully soon, you know, all judges will at least understand sort of the language that we're using and what that means. But for now, I just build it into the plan that I'm going to have to teach them a little bit before we actually dive into, you know, the details of an analysis.
How do you prevent crypto from being used for things like things on the dark web and illegal activities?
So how to prevent it? I mean, I don't know if you can prevent your spouse from doing that necessarily, other than just asking a lot of questions and wanting to be more involved in their cryptocurrency activities and just staying involved and staying curious. And I think that's the most important thing for spouses to do, is just be curious and ask questions. But I mean, luckily now a lot of the dark web stores, they will pop up. They're very easy to identify for us. We can see when someone sent funds into a dark web store. It happens. Luckily, I haven't had anything with a remarkable amount of money going into the dark web. So hopefully that means that whatever was purchased there was something very small or something they probably could have gotten off of Amazon. But in some cases, it's pharmaceuticals. You just never know. But I think a lot of the time we see people, especially between the years 2016 through 2019, a lot of people were just kind of testing the waters. Like, what can I do? Where can I spend crypto? You couldn't spend crypto in public marketplaces yet in the United States. So they're like, well, what can I do with this? This is interesting. And like, most of the time, just trying to figure out, you know, its uses and where to spend it. And the only places really to spend it were on the dark web. Although Amazon was taking BitPay, so maybe that's not a very valid excuse.
And so for the future, do you envision a world where we've gotten completely out of cash and we're just carrying around these wallets in our phones or in our, I don't even know, our wrists and just purchasing cars and groceries that way, and there's no more credit cards?
Ooh, I haven't even thought about that. If that is in the future, I think we're a long ways off from it. I hope I'm not going to eat my words on that. But I do think there's so much that still needs to be done in the way of like regulation and government policy to protect, you know, everyone in the United States using the financial banking systems from the risk that cryptocurrency does present. And, you know, especially with the biggest risk that we brought up earlier with like, you know, how good hackers are getting at actually getting through cryptography, which is like a really big deal. I think we've got a long way to go before we're entirely reliant upon blockchain technology, but it is taking over. It has been taking over for a long time. And I think a lot of people are surprised when I tell them, like, you've been using blockchain technology and you didn't even know it. You know, you've been using that since probably 2019, 2020. A lot of us didn't know when it started to actually become integrated into our economy. But I mean, even during 2020, I know Amazon was utilizing blockchain technology for the supply chain. And that wasn't necessarily a cryptocurrency aspect. It was just sort of like a more encrypted method of actually handling supply chain issues. And so that actually kind of helped with like streamlining efficiency during the pandemic to get people what they needed and to order things efficiently.
Oh, interesting. I wasn't aware of that.
I mean, I guess maybe we are closer than I think, but I think we're a long ways out. But then, yeah, I mean, you always find out things after they've already been integrated. So who knows?
And so I guess a $1 billion question is, what type of crypto do you hold? Are you currently holding?
Well, I think the only cryptocurrency that I've ever personally found a reason to invest in is Bitcoin. I've been in it for a very, very, very long time. Well, longer than most of my clients, I'll put it that way. So 2014, I think I've only had one client that had it longer than that. But 2014 was when I finally came around to it, right around Coinbase. It was kind of making the waves on Reddit. And so I fell right into the trend. But I'd already, you know, I'm an elder millennial. So I was part of the whole, you know, the crash of 2008 and the emergence of Bitcoin in response to the economic crisis and the recession and, you know, the Occupy Wall Street marches and stuff. So I understood that this had been around for a long time. I understood kind of like the purpose of it, but I didn't really firmly believe that it was here to stay until I started to see like actual exchanges, until they really made it possible for us to very easily connect our bank accounts and exchange cash for crypto. And once we kind of had that option to put cash into crypto, and then, you know, that gave you the sense that like, oh, okay, well, if, you know, things start to head south really quickly, I can always just cash out. Where before, you didn't really have that sense of safety. So Bitcoin's really the only one that I've held for a long time. Although when I'm on cases, if I see a cryptocurrency that I'm not familiar with, if I see a digital asset that I'm not familiar with, I will tend to hop on and go buy some and figure out what its uses are so that I can kind of figure out the activity that I'm looking at, because there's no like manual for any of this stuff. It really is very like, you should get your hands, you know, in the mud a little bit and see, why would someone buy this? What is it used for? Did they get it for free? Like, is this one of those like learn and earn things, the giveaways? Like, or are they developing a technology? And especially in high net worth divorce cases, we do see a lot of, especially with Silicon Valley area, we see a lot of these CEOs or people who are pretty high up in their companies testing the waters with blockchain technology and figuring out how they can, you know, utilize it for their businesses. So if that's the case, we want to recognize when that's happening. So as a result of that, I have a lot of different small amounts of a lot of different cryptocurrencies, but that's pretty much it. I mean, I can't say that I'm holding on to them because I believe in them, although they do seem to climb sometimes. And I'm like, oh, I forgot I even had that. I thought it was only like 2 pennies before, and now it's a few bucks. Like, it is what it is.
And so as far as tools and analytic platforms for your forensic analysis, what are the differences? I've come across something called Chain Analysis, TRM Labs, Elliptic. What are those really used for?
So I use Chainalysis myself, but I know Ari from TRM Labs, and TRM is phenomenal too. Elliptic's another great company to utilize. But basically what they're predominantly used for is they have a tracing mechanism that allows you to kind of more easily and very rapidly trace through wallets, trace into exchanges. It tends to identify wallet addresses. We call those attributions. It'll attribute an address to an exchange or to an individual. If it's been registered somewhere, they kind of put in a lot of work to do the research for you so that you can identify when funds are entering into an exchange. I have noticed recently that public block explorers, the free ones that we use, those are starting to identify the same types of things. So I think that, these other platforms that we're paying quite a bit of money to use are looking into other options and starting to explore being able to trace across different chains in the same graph, which previously wasn't possible. So it basically creates a more robust method of tracing. So now instead of having to open a different block explorer for each different cryptocurrency or blockchain, you can do it all in one place and see the whole big picture all at once. And that's actually really helpful for, you know, whenever we're meeting and conferring with the other side, we'll pull open our graph. And if they have a graph, all the more better. Oftentimes, if they're using similar technology or a similar method, our graphs actually overlap. We're seeing the same things, and that's like a really great feeling. But in events where, like, you know, the opposing expert doesn't actually utilize that same platform, it's nice to be able to kind of share the screen with, like, you know, I call it the class, but like share the screen with opposing counsel, opposing expert, sometimes opposing client, and show everyone what we're seeing and allow them to kind of ask questions and like, oh, well, what's that? Where does that go to? And like, I'll click on it and show them. And it actually makes for a very interactive tracing experience that a lot of people really enjoy.
Oh, super interesting. And so do you see AI playing a part in what you do as well in the future?
I think so. I think we're already starting to see some AI with mostly in scams. A lot of AI integration, a lot of like, the sort of automated way of opening up wallets, a lot of wallets all at once and kind of single use wallets to transfer money and then that's it. But in terms of like helping us with our job, I mean, I hope we do. Right now, AI is kind of useless as far as I'm concerned. When you ask it a question about crypto, it has no idea what you're talking about, but it'll answer so confidently. But you have to really be careful when you're asking AI anything about cryptocurrency because it will give you some really, really bad information. And it will talk about, you know, policies and regulations that don't exist or that only exist in other regions or that were just, you know, discussed but never actually implemented. And it'll spew it out like it's a fact. It's very, very crazy.
That's scary.
Yeah, it is. And it's frustrating because sometimes clients will hit you up like, hey, so I asked ChatGPT about this and this is what it said. And you're like, no. And now I have to like unlearn you from that. I have to like teach that out of you and explain to you why that's not the case. But sometimes that's helpful too. So it is what it is. But yeah, hopefully AI will learn from everyone's questions and everyone's knowledge and the internet and start to kind of piece things together a bit for us.
Wow, super interesting. And so has there been a case that is one of your most like memorable, most rewarding case that you've worked on?
Oh gosh. I mean, I think the most memorable one would be the first really, really big case that I worked on. I think they're all pretty rewarding, especially when you can get both sides to understand the activity and to agree to it. And, you know, they walk away satisfied. It's never a good feeling if one person feels like they don't understand it or they don't trust you or they have someone who's not a real expert. Sometimes we see people hiring technology experts that come in and they will do more harm than good sometimes. So the goal is always to like get both sides to walk away satisfied and happy and believing, you know, seeing for themselves that this is the full complete tracing and nothing's hidden. But the first really big one I ever did, it, you know, there wasn't really a strong methodology that anyone was using for tracing cryptocurrency in a forensic accounting setting. And we had to really figure it out from the ground up, and it took a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. I mean, an emphasis on the tears. It was like months and months and months of hard work and learning a little bit of developing, and then, you know, creating an internal model that, you know, we engineered from within CBIZ. And it took a lot of hard work from a lot of people to create it. But I mean, without that case and without sort of identifying the necessity for it, it would have never happened. But I didn't even know for sure that this was like the correct way to fully trace something. I was using the same tracing methodology I would have used with, you know, a standard transaction tracing with cash and trying to apply it to crypto. But that's difficult to do when you're working with securities. So it's like, okay, well, this is a little bit like a brokerage tracing. And it wasn't until we got to like that bottom line and everything tied out to the current balance screenshots that we got from all the exchanges and wallets, and until we gave it to the opposing forensic and they actually were able to understand it, go through it line for line, agree with it, and their client, most importantly, was satisfied with it. I mean, it was a multi-million dollar breach of fiduciary duty claim, and a pretty serious one too. And she, like, I expected her to kind of push back. I expected a lot of pushback. I had a couple of questions from them, but I walked them through it and she was totally satisfied. I didn't see that coming at all. So that was like probably the most rewarding feeling, was like, I know I did this right. And even still, sometimes I'll go back and look at that. That was several years ago, but I'll go back and just check it. Like, okay, well, did I do that? And then I see that I did. And I'm just like, oh, that's like such a good feeling. Like,
that's awesome.
It's always hard when you don't have someone above you or an example of someone who came before you to kind of to go ask questions and like help walk you through it. So it's nice when you you put in that kind of work and you see the payoff, and it's always nice to see clients walk away happy.
That's amazing. That's why you're the queen of crypto tracing.
Too sweet.
And as you know, our the ClickLine podcast, When Everything Clicks, it is about things in life that were never taught. And all of a sudden, when there's a moment where things click, when was there a time in your personal or professional life that something clicked for you?
You know, I would have said the example I just gave, like getting that kind of feedback from the clients and seeing the result of it and having it really literally click, like, okay, we did this right. We're on to something that like no one else has done yet. And like, we can help teach other people. But the only way I would have gotten there is actually it's only because I actually went through my own divorce when I was a lot younger. And I was actually the spouse that was struggling and afraid of the legal system and afraid of my ex and afraid of his parents and all the money they had and all the attorneys they could afford. And I was somewhat kind of pressured into taking a certain settlement arrangement that I was not comfortable with. And that stuck with me for a long time. And then when I started working in forensic accounting, it was kind of by accident. I had intended to become an engineer and I was in school for engineering. And I ended up taking this job at a forensic accounting firm and literally told them, like, this is temporary. I'm not going to work here very long. But, you know, 6 to 9 months in, I realized, like, these are people who are in a position a lot like my own. And I found, like, a total calling in it. It was very, very rewarding work. And it, like, I guess in a big way really clicked for me that that's why this happened to me. If everything happens for a reason, that's why I went through this. And that's really so that I can empathize with other women, other individuals who are, you know, in that really scary position. Divorce is scary itself, but when you're not familiar with what you're entitled to, what your rights are, what's normal, what's not normal. I mean, as women, we never want to inconvenience other people, right? Like, you always kind of want to make things easy on people and make everyone like you. But like in divorce, you can't be that way. And you really need people who can step up and like have your back and like, you know, tell you exactly what you're entitled to, tell you what the process is, tell you what to expect, and not make you feel like you're being greedy for asking for things that you're totally entitled to. So I think like making that connection is really what clicked for me. And now I feel like I'm where I should be.
Totally. That's like destiny for you. And I feel like things happen in life unexpected, and we think it's unexpected, but it's all part of the journey. And I think there's multiple chapters and multiple levels to the journey. And, you know, whatever we think in our mind is the career or the life that we thought we're supposed to have, it's still being written, is what I say.
Yeah, life has a way of reminding you that you're not always in control, for sure.
Yeah. Well, I love that. And thank you so much for taking the time to be on the Click Line. I know you're super busy and high in demand. So thank you again for being with us, Victoria.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Mina. This was really fun.
Don't forget to send in your questions and comments to the Click Line. And one more thing, the views and opinions expressed on this podcast are for informational and entertainment purposes only and should not be considered professional advice. Please consult with qualified professionals for advice related to your specific situation.